thought of beginning this talk by showing a video of myself fluffing some notes as I played a difficult guitar solo. But then I decided against it in case it looked too rigged, too deliberate. But it wouldn't have been, because the fact is I never played the guitar as well as I used to play it. And there are two main reasons for that. And the first is that at 67 and 3/4, my fingers are not as agile as they used to be, a little bit of arthritis creeping in. And the other far more significant factor is the almost total lack of practice and playing that I've done, particularly during the last 20 years. In other words, I've neglected the disciplines. Scales with my left hand, picking techniques with my right hand. I know what my right hand's got to do. I know where my left hand's got to go. But I can't do it quickly enough to do a fast solo because I haven't practiced the basic disciplines that will keep me up to speed. And occasionally I'm living to regret it, particularly when I get together with my thumb band. On a more spiritual note, I've long had this feeling that one of the biggest factors in our effectiveness as believers is the extent to which we practice the spiritual disciplines. In other words, the degree to which we consistently exercise our spirits. In a book called Disciplines of a Godly Man, a pastor and author called Ken Hughes said this. He said, we'll never get anywhere in life without discipline. Be it in the arts, business, athletics, academics, whatever, this is doubly so in spiritual matters, he said. In other areas, we may be able to claim some innate advantage, he continues. An athlete may be born with a strong body, musician with perfect pitch, an artist with an eye for perspective, but none of us can claim an innate spiritual advantage, he said. But none of us can do that. In reality, we are all equally disadvantaged in spiritual terms. None of us naturally seeks after God. None is inherently righteous. None instinctively does good. Therefore, as children of grace, he says, our spiritual discipline is everything. Our spiritual discipline is everything. Just one more thing to look at before we look at three essential spiritual disciplines that are on display in John 12, the reading that we just had read to us. And it has to do with this word discipline itself. It's not a very popular word these days. It's a term that many people, including a lot of Christian believers, are very wary of. Maybe that's because one definition of the word goes something like this. Discipline, the practice of training people to obey rules. People don't like rules. Or a code of behavior, using punishment to correct disobedience. People don't like punishment. That is not a definition of spiritual discipline. Obeying rules. Using punishment. So please don't stop listening if you want to start it. Because we're looking at things that I'm calling disciplines. Because another definition of discipline is simply this. An activity that provides mental or physical training. Or in our case, spiritual training. Here's another Christian author called Donald Whitney. He says the spiritual disciplines are those personal and corporate disciplines that promote spiritual growth. A man called Jerry Bridges, who was part of the Navigators organization, said this, spiritual disciplines are provided for our good, not for our bondage. They are privileges to be used, not duties to be performed. So please banish any thoughts you may have of legalism. Would you think it legalistic to discipline your children, to tell your child to clean his teeth? My wife would be absolutely, well, I don't know, because she's a dental nurse, so she would not be happy if you didn't tell your child to clean his teeth. What about eating greens? What about doing the homework? Of course, we discipline our children. We train them to do these things. And practicing spiritual disciplines is something like that. It's not a form of legalism. On the contrary, if these disciplines are prayerfully and joyfully undertaken, they will be a great help in us finding a new level of freedom and godliness and abundant, effective Christian living. And those are things that bring even greater joy in their way too. That's what we're looking at tonight. We're looking at three essential disciplines, spiritual disciplines. And they all crop up in that passage that we had read to us. We find a verse in the end of verse 2 where it says this: Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. So our first discipline is this: Lazarus fellowshipping with Jesus. Just imagine it. Reclining at a table with Jesus himself. The one who, just a short while earlier, had restored your corpse to life. Once you've had this privilege to dine with the one that everyone was talking about, to share a table with the life-giving Jesus. Amazing. And yet, what did the risen, glorified Jesus say to the rather tepid church in Laodicea in Revelation 3:20? Some of you could recite it. Here I am. I stand at the door and knock. And if anyone opens the door, I will come in. And what? Eat with him. Eat with him. And eat with me. And remember, that wasn't so much an invitation to people who weren't Christians. It was an invitation to those who had already met Jesus and trusted Jesus, but had somehow shown out in their lives. And he said, look, I want to come back in. I want to come back into your church. Open the door, and I'll come in, and I'll be with you. I love the way that Mark describes the calling of the 12 disciples in chapter 3 of his gospel, verse 12. He says, Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12. Here it is. That they might be with him. That was the primary purpose. That these men should be with him. Yes, to learn from him, to see him at work, to follow his example, but to learn from him and be with him. Standing as it may seem, dear friends, that's what the Lord Jesus wants of you and he wants of me. He wants us to be with him. He wants to connect with us, to use a modern term, to do life with us, to just be with us. And yet how often do we ignore opportunities or fail to plan them into our busy schedules or daily to-do lists to be with Jesus? And I'm generalizing. I'm saying we to include myself, but I guess that some of you are really good at this. I would imagine that amongst you tonight there are people who are really good at this particular spiritual discipline. Spending time with Jesus is something you excel at. Just being in his presence with no other agenda. But to focus on him and be with him. Many of you perhaps will treasure times like that. But some of us, and I include myself in this, are easily distracted. My wife will tell you I can't sit still for 5 minutes. And it's very difficult for me to really focus on the Lord. Patient sitting and diligent waiting doesn't come naturally to me. Maybe it doesn't to you. We marvel at that old hymn writer who wrote these words, the pure delight of a single hour. That before thy throne I spend when I need in prayer, and with thee, my God, I can move as friend with friend. And yet some of us have never passed the 10-minute barrier, let alone got to an hour in the presence of God when we've tried to do that sort of thing ourselves. However, I have been slowly learning. I'm a late learner, as I said, I'm 67 and three quarters. And I've been slowly learning that Jesus enjoys walking every bit as much as he enjoys sitting or reclining with us. But what matters to him is not so much the where and the how, but the why and how often. He's as happy to meet with us in a workshop, in a kitchen, in a burger's there, in a gymnasium, as he is in a room in our home. Are you with me? Wants to be consciously with us and for us to know that he's with us. And the Lord has been reminding me yet again that this kind of fellowship is absolutely vital if we're going to be healthy believers, strong Christians, simply being deliberately and consciously in his presence is something we dare not neglect if we want to be spiritually healthy. Where that happens is neither here nor there. Pretty much anyway. It's the frequency of our fellowship, the length of time we spend with Jesus, that's far more significant. Being with Jesus, fellowshipping with him. We should not be surprised at our spiritual ineffectiveness, our spiritual frailty, if we don't make time regularly to be alone with the Lord. We shouldn't wonder at our lack of Christ-likeness if we don't give time to being in his presence. a young preacher called Kevin DeYoung put it like this: if you want to be Christ-like, you need to have communion with Christ. We learn it from him. We pick it up from the inward. That's the first of three central spiritual disciplines that I found in our reading. Being able to be with the Lord habitually, spending time in his presence. Here's the second: Mary worshipping Jesus. Verse 3, Mary took about a pint, half a litre, of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. I have a Bible app on my computer called Logos. It means the Word of God. I just have the basic Cree edition. But even that comes with several different versions of the Bible, super fast concordance, Bible dictionary, number of commentaries, book of word studies, and an excellent collection of maps. It's amazing. It's one of my go-to things. Just hover over a word in the text, and the original Hebrew or Greek term will pop up and gives you its meaning, and so on and so forth. It's amazing. But one thing it doesn't do, with regard to this scene in John 12, is reproduce the smell in the room. In fact, there's little point in me saying to you, look, I want you to imagine the smell. Because most of us wouldn't have a clue what pure nard smelled like. And what we could really do with is a scratch and sniff card. Do you remember those? A scratch and sniff card. But there are a couple of things that we should notice about this lovely act of devotion that I believe would challenge us with regard to the reality and the depth of our worship. First, John tells us it was an expensive perfume. My Logos app tells me the nard is an oil that comes from the root and the spike of the nard plant, which is why it's sometimes called spike nard. And one of the books that I read by a commentator called Hendrickson says that nard is an aromatic herb grown in the high pasture land of the Himalayas between Tibet and India. And in view of the fact that it had to be procured in such a region so remote and carried on camelback over miles and miles of mountain passes, it was very highly priced. And notice that Judas objected to the extravagance of Mary's act. He said it was worth a year's wages. Larry Richards, in his commentary on the whole Bible, suggests that because of its value, this perfume was often purchased as an investment that would increase in value over time. So the nard that Mary poured over Jesus' feet may well have represented her life saving. There it was. Gone. Running all over the floor and over Jesus' feet. And she can hardly go around afterwards and gather it up and use it again. And Mark has the detail in Matthew and John the Evangelist. It says that Mary even broke the jar, this alabaster jar, releasing the perfume. What a costly thing to do. What an extravagant demonstration of devotion. This was a sacrifice of love. And whenever I read this story, I am challenged anew with respect to my own personal worship. This was an unstinting act of devotion and suggests to me that my worship should at least on occasion be both joyful and extravagant. Back in the day, I would heartily and joyfully sing that song that we just sang. We bring the sacrifice of praise the house of the Lord, but what sacrifice? Oh, this has really made a sacrifice to be here this evening. Okay, we've given up an hour or two of watching the telly or whatever it is, or reading a book. But what sacrifice? Does our worship ever really demand much in the way of sacrifice? Does it ever cost us anything? Because in a way it should. Psalm 51:17 says the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit and a contrite heart. In other words, just as Mary broke that delicate, beautiful alabaster box, so we must be prepared to be broken. What's that mean? What does it mean to be broken? My mind went back to this is again just confirming my age. My mind went back to this old cowboy series that were on the television donkeys years ago, probably in black and white, things like Bonanza, the High Chaparral, do you remember that? One of the things that cowboys used to do routinely was to break horses. And in that context, the word break and broken have to do with the will. The cowboy broke a horse in order to bring it under his control, rather than lead it to its own will, so that his mount would go where he wanted it to go, and as fast or slow as he wanted it to travel. He broke it. He broke its will. Remember what Paul said to Roman church in Romans 12. This has a New Living Translation puts it. Dear brothers and sisters, I plead with you to give your bodies to God because of all he's done for you. Let them be a living and holy sacrifice, the kind he will find acceptable. This is truly the way to worship him. Truly the way to worship him. So when we bring our songs to God, are we kind of subconsciously also bringing our whole selves to him as well, because that's what he wants? And that's costly. And that's a true sacrifice. The praise isn't just one hour of our time on a Sunday afternoon. He wants us 100% lock, stock, and barrel. I ask myself today, as I put it to you, is my worship costly? Is it in any way sacrificial? That's the first challenge that Mary's worship presents to us. Second comes out in the second half of verse 3, where John says this: she poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Now we can try and imagine this scene to some degree. The guests are reclining at this table. So it's not a table like this where you sit on a seat like that. The table would have been down there. You'd be lying on your side, propped up by your hand and your elbow on the ground, and you sat around the table like that. And the room smells probably a little bit like the inside of a Greek restaurant. It's filled with the aroma of herbs and spices. And Lazarus is there, back from the dead. And everyone's happy. Where wouldn't they be? The party's going well. When all of a sudden, there's this powerful, beautiful fragrance overpowering the smell of olives and cumin and everything else. And it's not one of your cheap Korean imitations. This is the real thing. This is pure spikenard. And it's heavenly. Where's it coming from? And then you notice her at the feet of the honored guest, Jesus. And she's wiping his feet with her hair. Let's face it, say the very least. A potentially very embarrassing thing to do. Very embarrassing thing. Everyone's eyes would have suddenly been fastened on this woman. She's unbound her hair. No respectable Israelite woman ever did that in public. May still be the case, I don't know. Certainly back in those days, they would never unbind their hair in public. Tom Wright, who was a former bishop, comments, that's roughly the equivalent at a modern polite dinner party of a woman hitching up a long skirt on top of her client. It's a similar thing. Embarrassing. But I want to suggest to you, it's just a theory, I want to suggest that as far as Mary was concerned, at that moment, she wasn't in public. She was in her own little bubble. Yes, she was surrounded by people, but she was in her own little bubble. And the only person who mattered to her at that moment was Jesus. She loved him. She wanted to pour out her heart in devotion. And this was an intimate moment between her and her Lord. And she gave not a fig for what other people thought of her. What an example. What a challenge to people like us, 21st century worshippers. But surely our worship, like Mary's worship, should be made up of selfless acts of love. And when we worship God, be it on our own or together in a congregation, our first thought and our main thought should be for Jesus and not for ourselves. So the Spirit does lead us, prompts us, moves us to reach out our hands, then we do it. To raise them in adoration, then we do it. As an acknowledgement of his greatness, we do it. And if we're the only person in the room with our hands raised, we should be noticing. Because we're in our own little world. We're so absorbed with God. Our focus is on him. We're not worrying what anyone else is thinking or seeing. Because we're so taken up with the Lord. I reckon that's how Mary felt. And that's how to worship. Perhaps one of our problems as 21st century British people is that we want to be ultra dignified in worship. And there's value in dignity. But what was dignified about Mary kneeling on the floor and wiping Jesus' toes with her hair? I'm sure some of the guests were squirming with embarrassment at this, thinking, what on earth is she doing? But what did Jesus say in Matthew 26? Here it is. She has done beautiful thing. She's done a beautiful thing for me. May the Lord free us from undue self-consciousness in our worship. May he bring us to the point at which our only real concern is for him and for his glory. That's the second of our essential spiritual disciplines. Lazarus fellowshipping with Jesus. Mary worshipping Jesus. Thirdly, very briefly, Martha serving Jesus. Just two words there, verse 2. Martha served. You know what it meant. Martha served. You may remember that on another occasion, Martha complained to Jesus that her sister was just sat at his feet, leaving her to do all the work. And Jesus said, Mary's chosen what is right. Is that what he said? He didn't say Mary's chosen one is right. He said Mary's chosen one is better. What is better? Worship is better than work in the sense that it should take priority over work, which is why we worship on the first day of the week and do our work on the next, however many days of the week. So it takes priority, but service should be a consequence of our worship. It should motivate our work. Our work should grow out of our worship. If we love the Lord, we not only want to worship him, we also want to serve him. So how can we do that? How can we actively serve the Lord at whatever age or stage of life we're at? Well, Martha waited on tables. When Jesus came to her house, she made sure the place was clean and comfortable, and she gave him something to eat and something to drink. Martha's was a very practical form of service. She washed the dishes. She beat the carpets. Maybe that's what you're good at. If so, great. You're a practical person. The church needs practical people. People who are good with their hands. So why not use those hands and those skills to serve the Lord? If that's you, remember Jesus' words in Matthew 25, verse 40. Truly I tell you that whatever you did for one of these least brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. Then again, maybe you're more like me. Two members of my congregation here tonight, they will verify that I'm one of the most impractical people that God has ever created. The only walls that I can build, which I once made of Lego bricks, like the ones I have, I got involved in our building project. I thought I should show my face as they were getting the George ready. And I said, what can I do? And the man gave me a long hammer thing with a great big head on it. And there's probably name for it, but I've forgotten it, because I never use it. But anyway, I picked up this thing and said, she's not going to that bit of wall back. And he stood by watching, making sure I got it right. And I sort of took a swing at it, and he swayed back and missed his nose by a couple inches. He said, Chris, that isn't your skill. Go home and use your gift. But if that is your gift, use it. And if you're better with your head than you are with your hands, or your ears, or your feet, or your mind is where your gift lies, use it. The possibilities are endless. But make sure you do something to serve the Lord. Could be just writing letters to missionaries. I say yes, that's a very important thing to do. To encourage them and give them a little lift. Some years ago, as I closed, in an article on the BBC's website, this is pre-pandemic, British gymnast Max Whitlock said that he'd been training in his garden to try and keep his Olympic preparations on track after the Tokyo Games had been postponed. Whitcock had won two gold medals in Rio, and he wanted to win some more, so he brought this pommel horse and put it in his garden. And he said, I think you just have to be creative with what you've got at home. Keep fit, keep active, here it is, and keep the structure of life as much as possible. As well as other vital disciplines, like prayer and Bible reading. The three that we've looked at this evening, fellowship with God, worship with God, service, for God, ought to be part of a believer's structure of life. But we who don't give up on easy, but that lives with us as we get older. The writer of the little town of Bethlehem, that Christmas carol, says we'll never become spiritual by sitting down and wishing to be so. No, it takes a little bit of work, it takes discipline, it takes training. But by maintaining our spiritual discipline, we'll do more than just merely spiritually survive. We will positively flourish and be fruitful for the glory of God. So in the words of Paul, as I finish, encourage one another and build each other up, just as in fact you are doing.